If you're a writer and you wanted to come up with the most terrifying concept of a serial killer, it might be someone operating without a clear motive, targeting victims across the country in various jurisdictions. Or, what about a group of killers working together, coordinating attacks that leave little to no evidence of their violent crimes? Both of those concepts are part of the provocative theory known as the Smiley Face Killers, aka the Smiley Face Murders, which connects dozens, if not hundreds, of strange deaths together, alleging that all the victims were targets of a killer or a group of killers that have yet to be caught. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. I'm Michael May, and returning from our previous episode is Bridget Weitzel. Hi, Bridget.
Hello, Michael May. How are you?
I'm good. And thank you for coming back. I wanted to tie these two together, so I'm so glad you were willing to do this.
I was super stoked you asked. This is fun. I love it. So thank you.
Yeah. So today we're talking about the Smiley Face Killers theory that has been floating around the halls and rooms of true crime for over a decade now. It's a very provocative theory, so I think it was worthy to learn more and to explore this. What's so interesting about it is there's no suspect. There's just this broad idea that there's a killer or killers attacking people very similar to Todd Gibb, who we talked about in the last episode. So before we dive into this, Bridget, do you have any other thoughts or questions or anything about the Smiley Face Killers or Todd Gibb?
I don't, I think I kind of did this on the last one too. Like, so many of these things are like in the ether, right? Like, you've heard little things about them, but there's so much information out there that you can kind of either choose to go down the rabbit hole and research them or just stumble upon things. And when you brought both of these to me, I had heard of Smiley Face Killer specifically, but I didn't know a lot of detail.
Yeah.
And I kind of decided just not to go down that rabbit hole because I wanted to learn about it here. And like I said, it's in the ether. People have heard of it. People know about it. But I don't know how many details and how much information people really have. So it's fascinating.
Exactly. And even the fact there is a movie that was inspired by this theory. I think it's called Smiley Face Killer or Smiley Face
Killer.
Bret Easton Ellis wrote it.
Yeah.
And it's not like I ended up not watching the whole thing because it actually has really nothing to do. It was just the idea of it was just the launching point for an idea for this movie. It doesn't really like go into the theory in depth. What I was thinking about doing today is sharing the basis for the theory, where it came from, what it is, and then some of the cases, because there are potentially hundreds of cases that people link into this theory. And when I say cases, I mean people that
murders,
potentially murders or drownings or drowning / murders that tie into it. So I'm just going to cover kind of some of the main ones that were in the original book written by the detectives that stumbled across this idea. First, I want to read a quote from a report that the Center for Homicide Research put together, which the take of this report is that the Smiley Face Killer theory is not real. It has its own conclusions built into it. It is still great research for this topic. And they have a quote in there that I love. Throughout history, society has always needed to produce monsters, often called folk devils, to help explain the unexplainable. Death investigation is one area inherently in great need of public explanation, but often lacking in available credible knowledge. And so I'll just leave it at that. I just thought
that's
was really
awesome.
Yeah.
Isn't folk awesome? Devils and like urban legends, I mean, people thrive on those, right? And then as they start, they just grow and evolve, and all of a sudden this tiny little story might just blow up into this big beast of a legend that everybody knows. And this is how it was, and that's probably not the case.
And the difference, which is talked about in a lot of the research I've looked at, but the difference between normal folk devils, which I love that term, or folk legends or any of that, is that these are real victims. It's not like, oh, my grandfather tells a story of this guy who died in the cemetery, but it's like you can never pinpoint who that really was and if that really happened. Where these are real victims.
Right.
And that's the difference with this one that is part of the intrigue of the theory. So on our last episode, we went over the strange case of Todd Geib, who had drowned. It was deemed an accidental drowning. There were strange circumstances surrounding it. His family thinks more happened, that there is foul play involved. So do mm-hmm. some of the detectives. And they want the case kind of reopened and explored more. And then at the end of that, I tied Todd Geib into the Smiley Face Killers because some people lump his case in with this theory as well. So for my listeners out there, I don't want to go over the Todd Geib case again. So please go back to that episode if you haven't listened to it. I do think it'll help you with this one. And I do want to share one thing that happened after we posted that episode. Todd's mom commented on the episode.
Stop it.
Yes. And the only thing she added is that, or at least at this point, the only thing she's added is that she says or alleges that someone tried to pick a fight with Todd at that party in the apple orchard. And she suspects it was to distract him from someone drugging him or putting something in a drink, or I'm sort of extrapolating from mm-hmm, that. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the key piece of information there, because I think I said in the episode, there's rumors of a fight. And some people say Todd wasn't involved. Some people say there wasn't a fight. Some people say a fight happened later. And right. So getting the details of that. But she alleges that somebody was trying to distract him by picking a fight to drug him. So
I'd be interested to know what leads her to that conclusion. I mean, you know, as far as the fight goes, again, not rehashing the last episode, mm-hmm. but there was no physical evidence of that on the body or really backing up that
correct
fact. So I'd be interested to know.
Yeah. And she obviously knows more about this than we will. So I was really appreciative to see that comment, and that was really fascinating. Wow. Yeah,
it is.
So the reason I bring up Todd Geib and that it's lumped together is that it turns out that there are many other cases with similar circumstances. It involves young college-age white men, just like Todd, found drowned under strange circumstances and typically after drinking the night before. Mm-hmm. Just like Todd Geib, a lot of them leave a bar or a party and say, hey, I'm going to walk home. And then they disappear for a while and they're found drowned. Now, mm-hmm. a few detectives noticed similarities with some of these cases. And initially, it was around 40 of them that kind of started them diving into this theory. And here, I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of this.
That's a lot. 40, like in during what amount of time?
Oh, like a decade or more. So it's not like all within 6 months or a year or whatever. Like
no,
many
but still,
years
40 yeah. within 10 years, that's a lot.
Yeah. So the theory of the Smiley Face Killer is that all of these men were killed by a singular serial killer or a connected group of killings. And now this is going to do a much better job of me explaining it. I want to read from the Center for Homicide Research in their report, because they do a nice job of summarizing. A theory has developed that credits the drowning deaths of a number of young men in the Midwest and Northeastern United States to the work of a serial homicide offender. In 1999, journalists first reported that college-age students were drowning in rivers after an evening of heavy drinking. These deaths were said to form a pattern, and it was soon proposed that it was the work of a serial killer or team of killers who were deliberately targeting young men for murder. Smiley face graffiti was sometimes, though not always, discovered near these death scenes. This serial murder explanation is now called the smiley face murder theory. Central to the claim of serial homicide offending is the alleged linkage of victims by the discovery of painted graffiti proximal to the location of the victim. The theory of these deaths includes offenders drugging a victim with GHB or similar drugs, abducting the victim, driving the victim around for hours in a van, truck, torturing them, and then slipping the body into the water. Detectives allege the motive for the dumping of remains into the water is to wash away evidence.
I'm uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable. I think that's why this theory is so, I say, provocative. Like, it mm-hmm. really gets your imagination going. It can either strike fear in you or strike, oh, that sounds stupid. Like, it definitely just provokes a reaction. And the
Without
idea,
a doubt.
The idea that there's this serial killer going around, and what's interesting about these, there's not really a motive. There's a type of victim But outside of that, there's really no motive that's been deduced within this. And that's terrifying.
That's really scary because you like to think, I mean, all the, you know, unsolved crimes that you follow and all the things that happen, you eventually they trace it back to a reason, a connection between the victim and the perpetrator. But this just sounds like this big, wide open 40 suspicious deaths. I mean, that's huge and makes you very uncomfortable.
Yeah. And at the same time, too, I can see why it's intriguing for, and I'll talk about who's behind this theory in a second, but the detectives that kind of started to formulate this idea, you have these strange deaths. And I'll just reference Todd Godd because we've gone over his case. But he was found floating oddly that they can never really describe. It looks like his body didn't decompose in the correct manner for how long he was missing and how long he was
so many
in
things.
Water. And there's all these strange things. And the fact that there's other cases very similar to that, where just like odd drowning victims, even if there is no smiley face killer or killers, that's still fascinating.
Really weird.
And creepy and weird. Yeah. So this theory has spread with amateur and professional investigators. They often, everybody that gets involved often attaches their own drowning cases that they've come across that they think could be plausibly part of this. And the vast majority of professionals, however, consider this theory to be busted. They call it more of an urban legend. And like I mentioned earlier, unlike other urban legends, this has real victims and real families that just want answers to why a loved one died, where they feel like the answers aren't being brought up or investigated thoroughly. Sure. And they just want these things to be investigated more completely. And that's what's kind of important about these stories. And spoiler alert, I do want to say this up top because the case is so well known. There aren't actually smiley faces found near or at all of the scenes. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, I think I read it was somewhere around 20 of the original cases that were looked at had smiley faces nearby. Right. And so that's just something to be considered. Also, there's this word I'm still a little confused about where this has shown up. But you also read about this word in graffiti sometimes found nearby. And I'm not going to say this correctly, but the word is Sinsiniwa, which is which is I believe it's a Native American word. And I think it means rattlesnake, and it has been found nearby as well. So some people attach that to this theory as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on.
Yes, please.
Yes.
It is interesting. Like you said, there's been so many different investigations and investigators that are all, they all have some sort of unsolved case, and you're trying to connect it to something and find some sort of through line somewhere to lead you to an answer.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you've got smiley face killers, but this matches, but there was no smiley face. And then this, you know, I can see how it can blow up into a big.
Absolutely. It does make a great name, though.
Yeah, like, it does.
There's a reason it caught on. That name is very powerful.
Marketing is very important in all aspects of things.
Yeah. So how did this thing start? I feel like I should have started the whole episode with this. Here's my format. It's been a little wonky today. So what is this theory? How did it start? It first came to public attention in 2008. And it's two retired New York detectives, Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte. They started kind of connecting the dots with these cases and started doing their own investigation into what they could be. And I think Kevin Gannon is the one that really started it before Duarte got involved. He was an investigator. I don't remember his exact rank at the time, but in the late 90s, he worked in New York. And there was a case that this all sort of starts with in 1997. With a Patrick McNeil. Now, Patrick McNeil disappeared on February 16th, 1997 in New York City. He was a 21-year-old Fordham University student, and he was last seen leaving a bar in Manhattan's Upper East Side where he had been drinking with friends. And despite heavy snow that evening, he left the bar alone and was, you know, walking home. Some witnesses report seeing him outside looking intoxicated, looking very drunk. Some reports also claim that there was a car following him when he left and he never returned home. Now, the initial response afterwards is that this disappearance prompted search by family and friends and law enforcement, as you would expect it would do. And despite these efforts, there were no clues, and nothing was really found until 2 months later, on April 7th, 1997, in the waters off Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, in New York Harbor. A body that was in an advanced state of decomposition was found, mm-hmm. but there were no obvious signs of physical trauma, and that made it difficult to ascertain a cause of death. And I believe the official ruling from the New York City Medical Examiner's Office was death as an accidental drowning.
Okay.
And the determination was based on autopsy reports, but it was still kind of hard to really get specific with it from what I've been able to deduce. And the theory that Kevin Gannon came up with, and even when he started working on these cases later with Anthony Duarte, is that they believe this was not an accident. And they point to several factors that are inconsistent with accidental drowning. The location where his body was found is a big one of those. It was really far away. And I saw an interview with Gannon where he talked about he researched like the currents and stuff of the rivers.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. And he was saying that it was way too far away for him going in the river nearby where he was last seen. He would never have ended up in that position. So he suspects that he was taken somewhere and dumped later. They also say that the body showed signs of ligature marks on his neck, though that isn't. That is not confirmed, just to be very, very upfront about things. And they also noticed what could be charring on parts of his bodies, parts of his body. And again, there's this report of a figure kind of following him, or a car following him, that some people said it's never been substantiated, but that is, you know, a witness account. And so, yeah, the theory is that McNeil was stalked, followed, abducted, then killed and dumped in the water farther away. Wow. And yeah. And they do say that smiley face graffiti was found near the site where McNeil's body was discovered. And that is kind of the hallmark, the thing that kind of instigated this, at least calling it the smiley face killers or smiley face killer theory. And that was the start of all. I've also read that Gannon was like moved by this case, and he never felt satisfied with this drowning. So he told the family, he's like, I'm going to keep looking into this. And that's part of how it kind of led to him discovering other bodies in similar nature and other cases, because he apparently wanted to formally solve McNeil's death.
So geographically, the other cases that get brought into this, I mean, it starts with this one that's in the Upper East Side, I think you said, of New York. Geographically, is he finding all the other victims and cases in the same kind of area, or what kind of, you know,
so it broadens,
are they covering here?
Yeah, it broadens out. And I apologize because I didn't really go methodically in order of cases. I just kind of looked at a big lump sum of the ones that I think are the most interesting. However, in generally speaking, what he's finding is the Northeast and Midwest. And that's when they kind of start, I think over the first 10 years or so that they're like putting this together and looking at things. That's kind of the focus. Since then it's grown. People that believe this theory are now adding other cases from all over the country, if not internationally. Mm-hmm. But as it starts, it's mainly the Northeast and the Midwest. And I should mention here, let me skip down in my notes to find it, but Duarte and Gannon ended up also working with a Dr. Lee Gilbertson, who's a criminal justice professor and gang expert. He was someone that didn't believe in the theory at first, and then he came around and started to believe it. They've also worked with a detective named, let me look this up, Mike Donovan, who's another detective that's been kind of helping the investigation along the way. And Dr. Gilbertson, I believe, Dr. Gilbertson helped write the initial kind of book that they used to talk about this, which was about deaths and drowning. And I believe Gilbertson is based in the Midwest, and that might be why a lot of the cases they ended up finding, like Todd Geib, maybe because Gilbertson's based in the Midwest, and maybe that was his focus. So again, generally speaking, Northeast and Midwest. Mm-hmm. That was a very long-winded way to answer your question, Bridget.
No, that's fascinating. I mean, it's all just so interesting, and it's interesting how you start with one case, and then all of a sudden you start realizing, oh, well, this was not connected in any way, shape, or form. But now that you're looking at it with different eyes and a different, you know, way of exploring, you start to find similarities across the board.
Absolutely. And speaking of those similarities, I'll go into a handful of other cases that put into this. And these are not in order of date. They're not in order of anything except just who I put down first through last. So I will mention dates and times, though, so we can at least mentally kind of know how these are happening. Mm-hmm. The first I'll share is Chris Jenkins, and this is in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on October 31st, Halloween. I didn't even think about that when I was writing my notes. On 2002. So Chris Jenkins is a 21-year-old University of Minnesota student. He disappeared after leaving a downtown Minneapolis bar. 4 months later, his body was found in the Mississippi River, still wearing... Oh, I did write down Halloween costume. So there you go. it was initially ruled an accidental drowning, like all these others. Mm-hmm. And the Minneapolis Police Department later reclassified his death as a homicide in 2006. But no suspects have been named. No one has ever been caught. And there's still a lot of questions around the face or around the case. A smiley face was allegedly found near where his body was discovered. I'm just always going to say allegedly because it's so hard to actually find. Like, where was this? So, like, there's always just smiley face found. And it's like, but where? What did it look like? What was going on? Yeah. In 2006, there's apparently an informant in prison that said that Jenkins was murdered. And I can't find a lot of information about that, but that is an interesting comment there.
Fascinating.
Yes.
But no reasoning as to why or who or what or and nope. And is it presumed based on your research that the reason it was changed from accidental to homicide was based on that informant?
I don't think it's because of the informant. I could be wrong about that, so please, listeners, if you know, write to me at studyofstrange@gmail.com. let me know. I don't know why they reopened it. I honestly just assumed, and assuming is not great. I should have done more looking into it. But I assumed it's because, like all the other bodies, it's not super clear that he died by drowning. And if he didn't die by drowning, then what happened? And I think there's probably pressure on the authorities, like all the other cases where family and friends and people are like, come on, like, you got to look into this more, at least. Stop saying it's closed. Like, there's questions around this. And so I think that may be why it happened. But yeah, I don't know for sure.
I think any kind of case like this, any kind of murder that's not very, you know, you can't trace exactly who it was, there's always going to be questions. And it's always going to seem like, well, if you don't have an answer, don't close it. Keep trying. Yeah. Keep seeing what shows up, even sometimes decades later. So absolutely, that makes sense.
And the next case I'll talk about is Dakota James. And this one is more, I think this is the most recent kind of main smiley face killer, quote unquote, victim. And Dakota James was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And this happened on January 25th, 2017. Dakota James was 23-year-old. He was a graduate student at Duquesne University. And he disappeared while walking home from a night out with friends in downtown Pittsburgh. His body was found in the Ohio River 6 weeks later, or about 6 weeks later. And I found this kind of terrifying, but there are some photos online of him from CCTV or security cameras, like stills of him leaving. And he's just alone, like looking at his cell phone. And there's something that really hit me about that, because it's like, that would be, if I was leaving a bar at night too, I'd just be looking at my phone and walking alone. And it's like, has no idea what's about to happen to him.
Absolutely.
And it's really sad. The Allegheny County Commission Medical Examiner's Office ruled his death accidental drowning. And Gannon and Duarte kind of got involved with this case very early on, from what I can tell. And they suggested foul play, citing inconsistencies in the autopsy finding, surveillance footage. And they claim they also found a smiley face graffiti in the area. There's a theory from locals that he was drunk and he went down to the river to pee. And that's how he died, as he fell into the river. I was found in the river. But they suspect he, you know, drunk, fallen in the river. Mm-hmm. As you and I have discussed in the previous episode, that does happen. That does happen.
Absolutely.
Quite a lot. So they are kind of valid in theorizing that. However, Gannon thinks that the body had ligature marks. And there were questions about the decomposition of his body, just like Guybe, where it didn't look like he had been in the water for nearly 6 weeks. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I also came across this story, and I don't know how real it is, but I came across a story that about 5 weeks before he disappeared, he had called his girlfriend and he was stumbling out of a hotel or his room or, you know, dorm, whatever. And she like saw him walk. I'm doing a terrible job explaining this, but she like saw him stumbling and she yelled for him to come back to her. And he like didn't hear her, and he was walking towards a van or an SUV, and she didn't know whose it was. And then she got his attention and he turned and kind of left the SUV alone, and the SUV sped off and went away. It's just kind of like a weird story. And I don't know how much, again, I don't know if it's real. I don't know what to think about it, but it is an interesting story.
If you were writing that in a script, that would be, you know, the foreshadowing for what's going to go sideways. Like, who is that? What do they have on him?
You 100%.
Know, why do they want him?
Yes.
And presumably, I would assume, again, this would be a full-time job for you at this point, researching all of this stuff, but like, what is the background with each of these victims? Do they have beef with somebody? Do they have, you know, things going sideways in their personal life, their professional life? What's happening? So, what's the history with these people?
Yeah. And it's just for the sake of this episode, I didn't dive into that, but other people have. And so has, you know, Gannon and Duarte, they've looked into that. And again, just because it's the best example we have, but Todd Gibbs, like whole thing, looking at him, did he have enemies who would want to fight him at a party? And
exactly.
They dove into all of that. So I do think they have done that. And for the most part, these are all well-liked individuals. They don't really have enemies. They tend to be athletic and friendly and outgoing and hanging out with friends. So they're tends
young
not
and
to
spry
be,
and active. And
Right. They also have said that there's a bridge. I think it's the Roberto Clemente Bridge.
I know that bridge.
Yeah. So there's talk that there's 11 smiley face graffitis on that bridge.
Oh, I don't like that bridge anymore. No,
right?
That's creepy.
Right?
Okay.
It is super creepy. And that's where he could have fallen off the bridge and into the water or dumped, you know, depending on what you think about this. What is really interesting about the Dakota James case is that apparently there were credit card transactions 2 days after he disappeared. And so that is intriguing.
That is intriguing. And in 2017, you would assume, I mean, we can't get away from cameras, right? Everything we do, you can be seen somewhere doing something.
Yeah.
So it's like if he was out and about or his cell phone records or something, it's 2017. It should be easy to get some sort of bearing on where he is or was at the time.
Absolutely. And you would honestly, it's a brilliant point. I would assume they've looked into that. And especially if they have those credit card transactions. So they must not have seen anybody. And it, you know, it may not be like an ATM which will take a picture of your face. If it's a credit card transaction in like a 7-Eleven or whatever, maybe the security cameras were looking into the corner where you can't see who it is. You know, like
so
there's
weird.
I wish we had answers, obviously. Mm-hmm. One other thing about this case too, that Kevin Gannon brought up is where the body was found and where he would have had to go into the river. He would have gone over a dam, and the body didn't show those kind of disturbances or marks or bruises or cuts or anything that would have happened if a body had gone over this dam.
And so that would be trauma.
Right. So trauma. Thank you. So the idea is, again, he didn't fall in where people say he fell in. He was dumped later down, you know, further down the river where he wouldn't have had to go over the dam like people suspect he would have if he had fallen in.
Or to be fair, if he's drunk and wandering, kind of like we talked about in the last episode, you can get turned around backwards and
that's true.
Up going in the wrong direction. So perhaps he went down to the river to pee or do whatever and ended up just kind of wandering in the wrong direction and fell in somewhere else.
Yeah,
it's the lack of decomposition after however many weeks of, in theory, being in the river that is the most bizarre to me.
Yeah. Indeed. And also it's that connective tissue to all these other cases where that seems to be the through line for some of these. So the next case, I'll briefly go over the next few here. So there's a Tommy Booth who disappeared on January 19th, 2008 in Woodland, Pennsylvania. or Woodline? I think it's Woodlin. Woodlin
Pittsman.
And Tommy Booth was 24 years old. He was last seen at Bootlegger's Bar, where he was attending a friend's party. 2 weeks later, his body was found behind the same bar in a creek. And what's important to note here is the creek was frozen, so they didn't find the body until the creek somewhat melted enough that like a body was seen, which brings up so many questions to me in this one.
So many.
I honestly wasn't going to include this case in it because he was found right behind the bar where he disappeared.
Yeah.
And that's different than the other cases in my mind, because it's like, what, was he killed just right there? Like, that doesn't fit what all this stuff is. And also, if there are more questions, is if the river's frozen, how did he get underneath the ice?
How quick did it freeze?
Like, yeah, there's a lot of questions I have about this case. However, yeah, how it ties into all this is it was ruled an accidental drowning. And there are obviously some bizarre circumstances to this. We've already asked some questions about it. And also, there's a smiley face graffiti found. It's like on the back wall of the bar, like underneath the deck. It's something like right there. There's one of these smiley face graffitis, which are super scary. The next case, Brian Welzian in Chicago, Illinois. This is on January 1st, 2000. Y2K, baby. After celebrating New Year's Eve with friends in Chicago, Brian was a 21-year-old college student and he went missing. His body was found 77 days later along the shoreline of Lake Michigan in Indiana. The official cause of death was undetermined, but there's speculation of drowning. Similar to Todd Guibe's case, there was little to no water in his lungs, which brings up the first question of, all right, why are you even
Doesn't sound like drowning.
Nothing? Yeah. That's kind of just for the sake of time here, I'll move on. But it's just, again, these interesting circumstances of drowning, but no water, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's two more I'll get to real quick. First is Lucas Hamann from La Crosse, Wisconsin. This is in September of 2006. He's a 21-year-old college student who disappeared after a night out with friends. And Hamann was an athlete in great shape, and his body was found in the river 2 days later, and local authorities ruled it accidental. And apparently, according to witnesses and tests and autopsies and all that, he was very drunk, but there was no drugs found in his system, and they did test for it. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on, because there is a lot of this theory is a lot of these people were drugged. There are no drugs found in Hamann's system. But what's interesting to me about this story, and the reason I included it, the difference in this case is that another student was charged with obstruction in the investigation. And they ended up not charging him with anything. But what he did is he gave conflicting accounts of what happened that night. He had told police that Hamann had gotten into a fight with another person at the bar and then fled. And then he was talking to friends and other students and said that he was punched, like Hamann was punched by a guy, and there were three men involved. And
what?
Whenever this guy was being questioned, he was super nervous around the police. So he had these conflicting stories. And yeah, I couldn't find much more about that. But it is interesting to note that there's somebody with information that is saying different things to different
people. And we've only gone through a couple cases and a couple little details, but every other case has been weeks before the victim was found, and this guy was 2 days, you said, after
yeah
he
I think
was found.
So
that's interesting to me as well.
Yes. All right, and the last one I wanted to mention is a guy named William Hurley, or Will Hurley. He's 24 years old, and he vanished from a Bruins game in Boston, Mass. Hmm. And he had left the stadium halfway through the match. He had called his fiance for a ride. When she arrived at wherever they had planned to pick up, he wasn't there. And she started asking around if anybody had seen him. And someone said, oh, he went to blah, 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 and like gave her a destination. She went there. He wasn't there. 6 days later, he was found in the Charles River near the stadium. It was considered an undetermined drowning. There was no blunt force trauma. Oh, sorry. There was blunt force trauma. To his head. Now, they don't know if that's because he fell and hit his head or someone attacked him. And the reason I wanted to mention Hurley's story even briefly like this is because he had GHB in his system. And it was above, which I'll talk about this in a little bit, all the GHB kind of talk around these cases. It was above normal natural levels.
I didn't even know we had GHB naturally in our system.
In fact, I'll dive into that now. So the big part of the smiley face killers is that a lot of these victims had GHB or something similar in their system. Todd Guy, there was the antidepressants. Mm-hmm. Other people, they claim, had GHB. What I found out is that everybody develops a certain amount of that after death. Whoa, did you put a thumbs up on my screen?
I did not, but that happened earlier too. And you didn't really see it. I thought it was coming from a text. That was weird.
That's crazy.
Where's that coming from? Who's doing that?
I think it's Ghost, Bridget. We found Ghost in our podcast, ladies and gentlemen. They are leaving us emojis.
I swear to God, if a smiley face pops up on the screen, I'm logging off immediately. Sorry, it's over. I'm out.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I wish I recorded video just for that one moment. That was crazy. Weird.
I thought that was a text I was getting, but that's in our thing. Okay.
That is in our thing. That is so weird.
WTF, Michael.
Wow. So, all right. Well, besides that, so GHB is found naturally in our bodies. Where it stands out in the Will Hurley case, however, is that it was above the natural amount that you would find. Why it's interesting to note that is when you hear that GHB is found in people's systems in these cases, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were drugged. So just I just want everybody to know that, because when I read about this case, I never hear that. I just hear drugged. And it's like,
yeah,
well, were they, though? Like, how much of it was in their system?
That seems like an important thing to indicate.
Absolutely.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so this is all based on, you know, the name the smiley face is because so many of them have smiley face somewhere.
Yeah.
This is just dumb. Maybe this is a dumb thing to say, but like, does the smiley face look the same? Because smiley face is a very common thing. You scribble it on pieces of paper. You put it on, you know, the fog on your car window or whatever. Is there something specific about the smiley faces that are found that ties them together?
Yeah. So you're teeing up where skepticism comes across in this theory. And I'm going to go ahead and have you read something that particularly deals with the smiley face. So if you got my email.
Let me look. Here we go to read. I'll start at the top. Okay, there is a problem of time order. In science, we have to show that the two correlated factors occur in the correct sequence. Smiley-faced graffiti must be proven to have been painted at or immediately after the time of killing. Some of the photographs of the graffiti show faded, worn-out paint that looks to have been applied years earlier. In other cases, the graffiti was found months afterwards. In many instances, no smiley face was found at all. Therefore, the finding of these faces is most likely the result of chance. Smiley faces were first invented in 1964. That's fascinating.
Right? Yeah.
I love that so much. First invented in 1964 and have since spread everywhere. They exist anywhere from children's stickers to commercial logos. One reason this graffiti is found everywhere is that smiley faces are among the easiest forms of graffiti to paint. That's fascinating.
Yeah. You can keep, is there more to, there's more to
yeah,
that, right?
There's
yeah, you can
two keep more. None of the smiley faces exactly match one another. There is no common paint stroke, height, width, curl, whip, or drip. This makes it difficult to connect one incident to the next in the process of what investigators call linkage. Also, no criteria has been established specifying the necessary distance that a smiley face must occur in proximity to a deceased body in order to be counted. In some cases, the smiley word Sinsiniwa, excuse me if I said that wrong, Sinsiniwa, is within close proximity, and with others it is quite distant. Estimating where the body might have entered the water is simply that, an estimation. Even when based on experimental testing, there are too many constantly changing variables to ensure accuracy. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of skepticism about this overall theory. We've already talked about some of it. But the smiley face one is a big one, at least in terms of like where it got its name and how you're connecting these cases together, where it's like there's not a smiley face at every one of these.
Right.
And if there is, there's no commonality between how far away it is. Mm-hmm. There's no commonality between what they look like, how they're made, when they were made. And you can find smiley faces pretty much anywhere with graffiti. So
pretty much anywhere. And a lot of these people are, the victims are being found in, you know, not the most public places. So behind bars, under bridges, you know, where people generally go to do graffiti and spray paint. So
absolutely. Yeah. And I also, I think I mentioned this, or I did. Yeah. Cincinnati is a word that means rattlesnake. And you can actually find that in a lot of graffiti around the Midwest, specifically Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois. And so it's not necessarily specific to these cases either. It's kind of like the smiley face where you just see it around a lot.
It's just in that region.
It's in that region. Also, it's worth mentioning that homicidal drowning is extremely rare. It's only 0.2% of all U.S. killings are homicidal drownings. And they tend to be highly emotional because it's like parents drowning kids or siblings or that kind of stuff.
It's a lot more personal.
Yeah. There's also, I did read this. I can't remember if it's in that same report. And I will have a link to that report that I'm getting a lot of this information from. But there's something I read either in that or somewhere else, which is that you can't rely on trauma or marks on your body from victims found in water. It's actually not very conclusive because so much can happen to skin and rot and bugs and falling. And so a lot of times when they say there's ligature marks on a neck, I do think people that are skeptical of this can say like, well, that doesn't prove anything though, because the body was in the water for a while. So those are some of the main criticisms of this theory. There's also the fact that there's really no motive. There's this commonality with like white college age males, and that could be part of a motive where it's like, hey, let's, you know, the people that have most of the, you know, parents helping them with money and they get more opportunities than everybody else, maybe we'll target those guys. But outside of that, there's not really a motive for that. And that's A, it makes it tough to investigate. But B, it also, people that are skeptical of this are like, well, killings don't just happen without motivation. Like, you got to have motivation. So that could kind of point away from a killer or groups of killers.
And the commonalities, honestly, when you really look at it, they seem very small.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, this person was drunk and was found in a body of water. Is that, I mean, that's a very, very thin thread, right? I mean, there's a few things here and there. You can see both sides, but I don't know. This one to me kind of feels like there's so many cases that can't be proven, like maybe there's one or two little questions. And as a family member, I would want all of those questions to be answered and cleared up, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you want to be able to know completely what happened. And I think that's just not the case sometimes. So it's easier as a society and as people with questions to tie it into a bigger question, right? And put it into this, like you said, this urban legend thing where maybe it is bigger than just what we were thinking.
Yeah. And we like that quote says, like, we want monsters. We want answers to why are these innocent people dying? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's helpful to think that there's a reason behind it besides just an accident, you know? Yeah. So I think that's a big part of this urban legend of this. And I do buy into that. I'm personally of the opinion that this is not a thing.
Yeah.
And there are people that are very much believers in it. And I think that's totally fine. And
sure.
The main reason is I think we need to investigate a lot of these deaths more. Not the hundreds of them that are potentially linked to all this, maybe not all of them, but like some of them. Like Todd Gibbs. Like, I think that case needs to be investigated more thoroughly.
I agree.
And so I think that's where the importance of this story comes in, which is like, let's highlight some of these cases that probably need more answers and see if investigators can actually find them.
I agree. Yeah. I think that makes complete sense. I mean, anytime there's any questions and it could be something different, I think it's worthy of putting the time and effort into investigating more deeply, you know?
Indeed. Well, that's kind of it. I mean, that is the smiley face killer theory. Do you have any other questions about any of these or comments?
I don't think I have any questions. I think I want to hear about a few more of the cases because it did become so broad and so wide and so many. Mm-hmm. There's got to be more things that connect. You know, I'm always open to hear.
Yeah.
You know, just based on what we're looking at, it doesn't seem like a thing to me, but the gentleman working the case, whose names have escaped my brain, they're clearly, you know, good at their jobs. They're educated. Yes. They do this for a living. And there's something in there that's making them think that there's a reason that these could be connected.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the kind of the downside of doing an episode like this, where I just kind of briefly go over some cases instead of doing a deep dive, because I just kind of have to research it that way. If I did a deep dive on each and every one of them, I would never get on to other episodes I need to do this year. No. But yes, there are smart people behind this, even if I disagree and I don't think there is a smiley face killer organization or person or whatever. I do think the detectives behind it, they seem very legitimate. I've really enjoyed a lot of the interviews I've seen with Kevin Gannon specifically. He just sounds very much like a New York detective. You know, I love listening to him talk.
Yeah.
but he doesn't come off as a kook or a weirdo or someone trying to sell books. Like he legitimately, I think, believes this and has a very good investigative mind. And I want to watch more of his stuff. Very, very honestly do.
Well, and honestly, that kind of is what makes a good detective, I would think, in some ways, too. Like, he's looking at something that can be debunked, but maybe not. So he's giving it, you know, credibility until he can prove that it's not.
And absolutely.
He clearly, with all of his information, hasn't been able to prove that it's not yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I did say, I think there is something to be said about where we are as a society where, you know, marketing is a thing, you know, and it's not like they're trying to market the smiley face killer, but it's catchy. It's a good name, you know, and it people can wrap their head around it easily. If you say there was smiley face graffiti nearby, you're picturing in your head some sort of image in all the cases, right? Even though what we just read was that it was not the same. I have something in my mind that just makes sense, and I can picture it under the bridge and near the canoe for Todd Geib and everything.
Yeah.
And it feeds into our imagination as well. And it just is, quite frankly, kind of freaking terrifying that could even be a possibility.
Yeah. Know? Yeah, exactly. That's why I wanted to learn more about this, because it's scary. It's very scary to think about. Yeah, when I first read, I don't remember when I first read about the smiley face killer theory, but it had to be about 10 years ago. And I just remember immediately going like, what? Wait, hold on. There could be like this mass serial killer or killers that are like talking to each other and like, wow. And they're getting rid of evidence. And oh my God, like it's.
And you're a white college educated dude that went to school and that would hit home for you because you fit the mold of the victims as well, right?
Yeah, thanks. So, thanks for bringing that up.
You know what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, that's great, Bridget. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this again. This is a fascinating story. And listeners, I always want to learn more. So please, if you want to correct me, if you want to add to this, email me astudyofstrange@gmail.com. I would really appreciate it. And Bridget, anything from you? Anything you want to plug here before we go?
No, I wish I got to come up with something good because you ask me that every time. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm doing my thing, organizing my cupboards, you know.
Yeah, it's important work, though. No, I don't want to just go, thanks, Bridget, and then hang up. You know, I want to offer anything. So,
I will say this, though, like for all your listeners, I have a pretty extensive library of, you know, true crime and mafia and stuff like that. And I'm super interested. And so at any point, if anybody has anything that they think that I should know or I should would be interested in, let me know. I'm on Instagram and, you know, Queen Bee on the move. And maybe I'll get to come back and be on A Study of Strange another time.
No, I'd love it. I'd love it. I love that you're willing. I love it.
Thanks, Mike. It's fun.
Yeah, thank you. Well, great. I will talk to you soon.
All right, be well.
Thank you for listening to A Study of Strange, and a special thank you again to Bridget Weitzel. She was on the show probably about a year ago on one of my favorite episodes, one of my favorite topics that I've researched, which was 19th century serial killers. Check that out. It's a great episode. And before you all go, make sure you subscribe and follow our show and leave a rating and review where you can. That really makes a big difference to allow more people to find the show. Lastly, if you enjoy content like this, check out our Substack. You can find it through the support tab on our website, astudyofstrange.com. It's a great way to support the show, and some of the content will be free as well for those that may not be able to support the show by subscribing to that Substack. But check it out. Otherwise, the best way to support us is just keep listening and keep enjoying the show. Thank you, and good night.